Be sure to friend us on Facebook. You can do it right now. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America or search for us at keyword Voice America.
The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
For Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right, good afternoon, everybody. Hope everyone had a terrific Thanksgiving. We are on to discuss the issues of the day, and we start off with some information about what the Obama administration might be up to in the next term in regards to national defense, national security and defense. And joining us is Jack Deshauer, who's one of the leaders of the Patton Boggs Foreign Sovereigns National Defense Practice. Jack's been a partner there for a great long time and has previously served as Director of Senate Affairs for the Secretary of Defense and very well versed in Homeland Security defense and tech transfer issues. So Jack, start out by giving us maybe a broad overview of what the Obama administration is thinking about as they put together their national security team for this second term.
Well, I think that the first thing is that within the national defense realm is the issue of the budget. Right now everybody's talking about the fiscal cliff and sequester and the impact of sequester on defense and on non-defense spending. But with the re-election of President Obama, the $500 billion cut that has already been programmed into the defense budget over the next 10 years obviously will stand. That was an issue that Governor Romney campaigned against and had promised that if he was elected would increase defense spending by some $2 trillion over the next 10 years. Obviously, because of the outcome of the election, that's not going to happen. And while most people in the defense industry and on Capitol Hill believe that the sequester will not take effect in its current across-the-board cuts to every defense program, the outcome of the fiscal cliff negotiations, whether it occurs before the end of the year or the beginning of early part of next year, means that there's going to have to be additional defense cuts. There's no way around balancing the budget and cutting discretionary spending without additional defense cuts. So I think that as the president looks to replace Secretary Panetta, who has announced that he was intending to leave his job as Secretary of Defense and retire, Secretary of State Clinton has indicated the same, and of course the unplanned and surprise vacancy at CIA, I think the president's going to need somebody at the Secretary of Defense's desk who has the gravitas to carry out the programmatic cuts that are going to still come with the re-election of the Obama administration.
Well, so tell me about some of the big obstacles in the national security realm for the Obama administration in the second term. And obviously, I think getting some people appointed has to be one of those obstacles, right?
Yes. I don't think, let's take CIA. CIA is in capable hands with the acting director, who is the deputy director, Mark Morrell. He's one of the names that has been floated and talked about in the press as a potential permanent director. So there's no pressing need to fill the Petraeus vacancy out there. Both Secretaries Clinton and Panetta had indicated that while they planned to leave the administration in the, if there was a second term, both of them have indicated that they would stay until a successor was confirmed. The federal budget gets delivered to Congress on the first Monday in February, which is right around the corner, so I'm sure Secretary Panetta will stay and be secretary when the budget's delivered, and will be the secretary who testifies on the budget for FY14 when the House and Senate kick off their hearings after the budget's delivered in February of 2013. And the same Secretary Clinton had said that she would remain until her successor is confirmed. With respect, though, to, you know, national security policy and the issues, there will continue to be those divides that were there before the election. Obviously, the House remains in control of the Republicans. Buck McKean of California is returning as chairman of the House Armed Services Committee. He was a strong supporter of the Romney defense platform, and a critic of cuts to defense. In fact, he was a leading opponent of the sequester and had tried to organize defense industry executives to oppose sequester, and was actually trying to do something to prevent the defense sequester before Congress went home for the elections. And so additional budget cuts, I'm sure, will be criticized and resisted by the Republican-controlled House.
You mentioned a few names here as you go. I was a little intrigued today to see in some of the publications that former Republican Senator Chuck Hagel is being vetted for both SecDef and also Secretary of State, although he would clearly be a backup to some of the other folks. I mean, are there names you want to talk about in some of these appointments?
Dark horses? Yes. I mean, none of these are secret. I was actually at the ceremony yesterday for the groundbreaking for the Vietnam Veterans Educational Center, which is going to be adjacent to the Vietnam Veterans Wall. And there were a number of people there, including Secretary Panetta. And, of course, the topic before the ceremony began was who was going to be the next Secretary of Defense. And Senator Hagel is well-respected within the military community. He's a Vietnam veteran himself. And so his name came up. John Kerry's name is in the mix for both Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense. I think that he would be a good Secretary of Defense, a person of gravitas, Vietnam veteran, highly decorated Vietnam veteran, saw naval service in swift boats. Long experience in international affairs, obviously, which qualifies him to be Secretary of State, but I also think it would qualify him to be Secretary of Defense, and the type of person who would be able to jawbone and twist the arms of his service secretaries and the chiefs of staff of the armed services into coming up with rational and but necessary cuts to the defense budget in order to help America's fiscal situation. One of the speakers at the event yesterday was former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mullen, who had long testified during his service as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff that the greatest threat to America's national security was our debt. And so, going back to Admiral Mullen's time as chairman, which, began some 5 years ago, Admiral Mullen and the Department of Defense, acknowledged that the national debt was a threat to security.
Interesting. And isn't there also a woman who has the potential to be on that list?
Yes, Michelle Flournoy, who had served as the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, During the first 3 years of the Obama administration, she was a veteran of the Defense Policy Shop. In the Clinton, during the Clinton administration, she was associated with a moderate defense-oriented think tank in the interregnum between Clinton and Obama. She's well-respected and certainly, you know, high on the list of potential secretaries of defense. If nominated and confirmed, Ms. Flournoy would be the first female ever to serve as Secretary of Defense.
Interesting. Well, tell me about some of the political impacts, pro and con, that face the president as he makes some of these decisions about who will be on his team for the second term.
Well, I think, you know, as everybody who reads the newspaper or watches the television news, you know, one of the leading candidates to be the new Secretary of Defense is the current Ambassador of the United Nations, Susan Rice. And most people probably couldn't have named Susan Rice before the deadly attack on September 11th of this year on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, Libya, which claimed the lives of four Americans, including the ambassador to Libya. Subsequent to the attack, she was on Sunday morning talk shows, and based on talking points supplied to her, emphatically stated that the attacks were the result of a spontaneous mob violence, and dismissed, you know, any concerns that the attacks, as they turned out, were a calculated terrorism attack by, you know, trained and equipped Al-Qaeda operatives. And so that has generated a lot of concern and controversy. Republican charges against Ms. Rice that she misled the American people before the election to sort of deflect any criticism of the administration's failure to properly protect and defend embassy properties in Libya. She, as the news has reported, made rounds this week, met with three of her most vocal critics in the Senate, Senator McCain of Arizona, the ranking Republican on the Senate Armed Services Committee, through the end of this Congress, but he will not relinquish that post at the beginning of the next Congress. Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, also on the Armed Services Committee, and Senator Kelly Ayotte of New Hampshire, another Republican and member of the Senate Armed Services Committee. And she also met with moderate Republican Senator Susan Collins of Maine, who also expressed some reservations about Susan Rice's qualifications. Now, the president actually responded directly to the criticisms of Senators McCain and Graham, and stood by Ms. Rice and her performance as the UN ambassador. But if she is nominated, that will be a long drawn out confirmation battle. Having served as Director of Senate Affairs, where my responsibilities were to shepherd all the nominations for the Department of Defense through the Senate confirmation process, including hearings before the Senate Armed Services, confirmation hearings before the Senate Armed Services Committee, you know, the opposition can make these confirmation proceedings long and very onerous by repeated requests for documents and repeated requests to interview individuals. And, you know, the administrations, not just this administration, but administrations tend to drag their feet and resist giving up, you know, highly classified documents in the context of a confirmation proceeding. And the opposition.
Jack, we're going to have to let it go there. We'll come back and talk some more in the future about these appointments once they're made, but we'll be back in just a minute with more Capital Thinking.
stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs. Straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business. Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back. Well, we are pleased to have with us Hannibal Kemmerer making his maiden voyage here on Capital Thinking. Hannibal is an associate in the Patton Boggs Washington, D.C. office, where he has a practice that focuses on both litigation and legislative affairs with a focus on the United States Senate and the Judiciary Committee's jurisdiction. He spent some time working on the Hill and knows a little bit about how Congress does work and sometimes how it doesn't work. But we have Hannibal on today to talk about a recent article that he authored in the National Law Journal talking about the very legalistic issue of judicial changes to reassignment of remanded cases. So, Hannibal, tell us a little bit about the editorial that you had in the National Law Journal. Maybe start at the beginning and explain to folks what reassignment and remand means.
Sure. So, reassignment is when a court of appellate jurisdiction, an appeals court, whether it's the Supreme Court or an interim appeals court, remands a case, sends it back to a district court and reassigns it to a different judge or orders the district court to reassign it to a different judge. It's rather rare, but it does happen on occasion.
Interesting. Well, tell us a little bit about what got you interested in this subject.
Okay, so the op-ed was born of my early litigation experience, but it's deeper than that. One of the cases I was involved in ended up getting appealed a couple of times, and we had the same district judge on remand both times, but it was on the same issue. It seemed to me that in order for the law of the case doctrine, and I can explain what that is if you'd like, to really work, one shouldn't have to appeal the same judge twice on the same issue only to win and then be sent back to the twice reversed judge. I also thought it was an odd proposition for courts of appeals to have the judicial economy as one of their considerations when evaluating whether to send a case back to the same judge. If there's a serious question about whether the trial judge could set aside prior views or whether there was a credible concern about the trial judge's impartiality, it seemed to me that if you have one or more of those concerns, no amount of judicial savings, judicial economy should result in a remand to the same judge.
Interesting. Well, I know you got a co-author, James Wirth. I believe he's an appellate lawyer at the International Trade Commission. Tell us a little bit about James and how you guys got together in putting this together.
Sure. So during my stint on the Judiciary Committee, I was flailing about during a congressional recess and looking for interesting things to read. My first chief counsel under then Chairman Spector was a bright guy named Mike O'Neill, who previously clerked for Justice Thomas.
Anyone named O'Neill is a bright guy.
That's right. And he always encouraged us over recesses that, you know, we should read widely, look for policy issues. And in the course of reading widely, I stumbled upon James Worth's article on destigmatizing the reassignment power. So if memory serves, James's solution was a little more nuanced. It didn't involve changing a federal statute. But I was a staffer on the Judiciary Committee. They say perspective is everything. And so, you know, I'm reminded of the famous law of the hammer. If you only have one tool, all problems start to look like a hammer. So the nice thing about working on the Judiciary Committee was that I could just call people up and they would respond. I got to the second James Worth I found on Martindale Hubbell and, you know, introduced myself, invited him to a lunch. We went to lunch at Union Pub, and the rest is a pretty predictable history. Kevin, do you want me to just tell you what the two changes we recommend are?
Yeah, please. Let's walk through those.
So the first thing we think should be done is federal law should provide that cases that have twice been reversed and remanded to the same district judge for the same reason, that they're presumptively reassigned to a new judge. It's a presumption that can be overruled, but it's a presumption. We call that a two strikes rule. The second change is we think that Congress should codify a modified version of the common law of reassignment. There is no sort of hard and fast statutory rule on reassignment. So we think that Congress should codify the first two elements and eliminate any consideration of judicial economy. Because like I said in the beginning, if there's a serious question about the judge's impartiality or willingness to set aside prior views, we just don't think that any amount of judicial economy can warrant reassignment to, or excuse me, remand to the same judge.
Interesting. Well, there's got to be some opposition to this proposal, right? I mean, is this something where if you're a trial attorney, if you're the federal judges, who's opposed and what are some of their arguments about why they think these things don't work?
Well, I think that there might be some opposition from folks who say, well, this is really just either for the trial lawyers or this is really just a smack against the head of, you know, district court judges. It's just unnecessary. In the piece, we talk about the three-part test and the primary cases where where that test came up were actually cases like United States against Robin in the Second Circuit and United States against Torkington in the Tenth Circuit. And those were cases where the assistant U.S. attorneys had brought up, you know, had indicted someone, and brought it before a judge. The judge dismissed it, went up on appeal. And after this happened a couple of times, the assistant U.S. attorneys said, look, you know, they cried uncle, and they said, we need a new judge on remand. And in Robin, the Second Circuit agreed, and in Torkington, the Tenth Circuit agreed, and they came up with this test. But we don't think that, you know, I think that illustrates the point that it's not just for civil litigants, it's not just for trial lawyers. Ultimately, the changes that we propose benefit people who prevail on appeal, whether they're prosecutors, whether they're, you know, it happen to be trial lawyers, whether they're defense attorneys. Remember, Microsoft got a district court judge removed from a case in an antitrust case here in the District of Columbia.
Interesting. I think you've mentioned one of the rules of a circuit in passing. Tell me a little bit more about that rule, and is the same rule in, apply in all circuits, or do they take a different approach?
Yeah, so most circuits just have that common law three-part test. But the Seventh Circuit, at some point before 1973, came up with this rule, hard and fast rule, that any case that's actually tried before a judge or jury that goes up on appeal and is remanded to the district court, all of those cases are automatically reassigned. So we think that, you know, that's odd. I mean, it's good in one way because you're reassigning cases, you get a fresh judge every time. But we think the rule might be a little bit over-inclusive. because what ends up happening is cases that are reversed not because of any fault of the judge, but rather because maybe a change in the Supreme Court precedent, so it's necessary to reverse it and send it back down. Those cases are automatically reassigned and probably shouldn't be. On the other hand, it's under-inclusive because it only addresses cases actually tried before a judge or a jury. I mean, one of the questions I would ask is, what about cases where there's a plea agreement or a dismissal or a summary judgment before a trial judge, and the judge actually evidences some bias or impartiality? I mean, surely we'd want to reassign those as well.
Yeah, that's very, very interesting. Hannibal, are there any statistics on how many cases, I mean, how big is the universe of cases that are impacted by something like this?
Yeah, I think it's under 100 cases a year, but I have to tell you, I've asked the Administrative Office of U.S. Courts for that very data, and you know, so far nobody's given it to me.
They don't keep those sort of stats, you think?
Well, either they don't keep them, or I just didn't ask formally enough.
I get very good. Well, what's been the response to the article so far?
So far, so good. I mean, I think, you know, the plan is, and I should say this is just James and my view, you know, that this isn't our client's views or Pat Mogg's views or the ITC's views, but the plan is to send a copy of the op-ed along with the actual statutory text that we propose to the Administrative Office of U.S. Courts. There's a subcommittee at the Judicial Conference and to the House and Senate Judiciary Committees just to see if it piques any interest.
Interesting. All right. Well, Hannibal, why don't you give folks your email address if they've got more interest, and tell them also maybe where they can find the article online.
Sure. They can find the article online. It's in the November 19th edition of the National Law Journal, and the title of the article is Judicial Reassignment, a Proposal. And you can reach me if you have questions about it at hkemerer@pattenboggs.com.
Great. Well, Hannibal, terrific having you on, and love to have you back when you get your next article in. We're going to be back in just a minute with more Capital Thinking.
Thank you.
The market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hola.
Konnichiwa.
Bonjour.
Hello.
From Anchorage to Abu Dhabi.
Marhaba.
From Denver to
Hello.
Doha.
Ciao.
Patton Boggs makes Nico. Business transactions Gracias. The world over.
Oi.
Rely on our insights for your next deal. Patton Boggs, the international business team. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio. Voice America Business Network.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattenboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattenboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back. We're going to spend some time talking about diversity in the context of law firms and the legal community. And joining us, two special guests for that, we have Joseph West. Joe is the president and CEO of the Minority Corporate Counsel Association, the MCAA, having joined there just about 15 months ago after serving as the associate general counsel for a small little company called Walmart. And also joining us is Mary Beth Bosco. Mary Beth is a partner of mine here at Patton Boggs in Washington, D.C., where she was the first female member of the firm's board of directors, and she is the current co-chair of the firm's diversity committee. So, Mary Beth, Joe, welcome to the show. And Joe, let's start with you and have you tell us a little bit about the MCCA and what its mission is in the legal world.
Sure, Kevin. Hey, thanks for having me. MCCA was established in 1997, quite simply for the purpose of trying to make the legal profession better by making it more diverse, focusing on corporate law departments and the law firms that service them. We do that in three primary ways. Publishing. We publish Diversity in the Bar magazine, which is the most widely circulated magazine of its kind. We also do networking and CLE events, I think best-in-class CLE events throughout the country every year. And the third area, I think the thing that is our sweet spot is education and training. MCCA has a very robust research portfolio of surveys, white papers, and in-depth reports. Some of them we do on a recurring basis, and some newer things that we've done in the last year or two, all available for free on our website at mcca.com.
Great. Well, tell me a little bit, Joe, about how big is the MCAA, and you know, who are some of the folks that are members?
Well, MCCA has two membership tracks. We've got close to 200 corporate members, as well as a large number of members of our firm affiliate network called FAN, which is the law firm network as well. And as I indicated, we've been around since 1997. We have a symbiotic relationship with our members. They support a lot of the research that we do and the networking and CLE events that we do. And likewise, we've introduced a number of training components, particularly focused now around inclusion and inclusiveness. So much of the dialogue of the last 20 to 25 years has been focused on diversity in the legal profession, which really stops sort of at the recruiting level. But with the significant attrition that we've seen for women and minorities in the profession, a lot of our focus now is on inclusion and inclusiveness, and a number of our training and educational and data oriented work is around those areas now.
Interesting. What types of, any more on the data and report that you produce and maybe how they're used in the legal community?
Well, sure. Since I think 1999, MCCA has tracked women and minorities in-house as well as in law firms. The law firm demographic survey that we do annually in conjunction with Vault, the Vault MCCA law firm demographic survey, has become sort of the gold standard for tracking corporate diversity within corporate law firms. And likewise, every year we produce the Minority GC Survey and Women GC Survey that tracks the diversity or lack thereof for women and minorities in-house, both at the GC level and beyond. We've also done created a new Academy for Leadership and Inclusion training program focused, as I indicated earlier, on inclusiveness, trying to stem the tide of attrition and provide not just robust opportunities to bring women and minorities into the profession and into law firms and corporate law departments, but keep them there, and to provide opportunities for advancement. Because statistics have shown that as you go through the ranks and progress higher up, both in-house and it's particularly acute in law firms, and I'm sure Mary Beth can talk about this in more detail, you have a significant drop-off in women and minorities in the profession. We have a Workplace 2020 study that we did that analyzed the work habits and practices of lawyers from Gen Y. And we have also a very significant in-house demographics and diversity and inclusion program analysis that came out last year that for the first time looks at the programs that corporate law departments have, examining how well they're working what their expectations are of their outside law firms.
Yep. Well, I want to shift to Mary Beth for just a minute and ask Mary Beth, in your work as a diversity chair at your firm, tell us a little bit about what you see as some of the big struggles large law firms or law firms of any size have to deal with in regards to diversity.
Sure, Kevin. First of all, I wanted to say we all here use the MCCA reports religiously, to read them, analyze them, and they certainly contain a lot of good advice and a lot of thought-provoking programs for us, and I know other law firms as well. So thank you to Joe for that work. And I would dovetail with Joe's comment. I think that here at Patent Blogs, we've done a terrific job of recruiting diverse classes from the law firms. We've really institutionalized those practices, and our recruiting committee has done a terrific job. The challenge for us, and I think every other law firm, is not just retention, but making sure that our diverse attorneys flourish as they become senior, both at the senior associate level and the partner level. And those are the challenges that we are really focused on at this point. One of the things we did this past year was had a wonderful program of diversity training by an outfit called Difference Works. They did it's a great program because it really talks about differences and how those differences are good things, and how to use the differences between the way we all operate to come up with better client teams, and also just emphasizing that the inclusion that Joe talks about is not happening, and that there, are some practices that still in this day and age occur. I think on a going forward basis, what we're working on is taking a page from Google, who got some publicity earlier this year, in doing some really focused studies about not just why people leave, but when they leave in their career. And, that should produce some interesting information in terms of policy issues that, we could do some changing, and also some predictive. We may be able to predict when in an associate's career they're most susceptible, and, we can do some intervention early on. And then I think the final piece of this puzzle for us going forward is as we hire, particularly at the lateral associate and partner levels, let's figure out what the model is, what's successful, and replicate that and make sure we are giving the people we bring in the tools to replicate success.
Interesting. Well, Joe, let's talk about some of those tools. What do you see as some of the best practices, the things that are really working in the legal world to increase minority participation in law firms?
Well, I think Mary Beth hit the nail on the head, and that is first looking at reasons why people leave. And firms like Patton Boggs and others that have gone beyond just the surface analysis and has actually taken steps to make sure that people have opportunities to grow and develop and flourish while they're there. First of all, it helps if when people do leave, there is some means of determining reasons why they did. The best way to do that, I've always thought, and the data shows this, is by using an independent third-party entity to conduct exit interviews. Look at that data that's produced and utilize it as a predictive measure. The other thing, frankly, is looking at whether or not there is a level when it comes to recruiting. A lot of the data we've looked at shows, and I've actually had people, partners in law firms, say to me that, well, the minority candidates that we bring in are far more qualified than their non-minority peers. And they say that as if it's a compliment, but that actually illustrates that there may well be a higher barrier to entry. and higher expectation placed on minority candidates than on others. A lot of the data also shows that attrition is particularly acute in the ranks of minority women in law firms. And I think an understanding and some sort of acknowledgement and work around the reasons why that is has to come into play. Statistically, minority women, 75% of them are either the sole or primary breadwinner in their respective households. 90-plus percent of them are likely to have primary caregiver responsibility for a collateral relative at some point during their careers. Neither of those statistics will apply to non-minority women or any other demographic categories. Firm takes a look at these kinds of this kind of data, accesses the information available from organizations like MCCA and others, and factors that into a comprehensive, not just diversity program, but diversity and inclusion program. I think they'll do a better job of holding on not just to the diverse talent that that they have, but to all of the talent across the board. I mean, the fact is, most corporate clients will tell you attrition is expensive. It's not desirable. The loss of talent and institutional knowledge and relationships that have developed is not something that corporate clients desire.
Let me throw that back to Mary Beth and ask Mary Beth, what sort of issues come from corporate counsel now as they seek law firms for work in regards to making sure that, that who does that work reflects the diversity of the population?
Well, Joe, I think Joe is right on and has hit this point. What we've seen more of is corporate law department saying not just we want a diverse team, but we want to make sure that the relationship partner is diverse. We want to make sure that diverse attorneys are given meaningful work on our projects. So, you know, there seem to be drilling down and recognizing that, you know, we can all play a numbers game, but the problem with the numbers is that they churn because, you know, your numbers, you know, you may have a great percentage of minority or women attorneys, but they're not the same from year to year because people are leaving. And so to drill into that, trying to make sure that these attorneys are included and are giving meaningful assignments is something that we are seeing from our corporate clients.
Kevin, and Mary Beth is right. I mentioned demographics and diversity program survey that's on MCCA's website that talks about what corporate law departments expect now. And what the data shows is that now 77% of all major corporate law departments track the diversity efforts of their outside law firms. 54% of them, and that number is expected to increase next year, 54% of them track the hours billed by diverse attorneys in their outside law firms. And I think what this shows is that, you know, a lot of firms have sort of, you know, consoled themselves, for lack of a better term, historically, with the thought that they didn't really need to make meaningful steps when it came to diversity and inclusion because there wasn't the client pressure there. There wasn't as much of an expectation from the client side. I think that's going to change, and it has already started to change.
Understandable. Mary Beth, we got about 2 minutes left. Anything to add on what Joe has said?
I think that by emphasizing the inclusion and putting in programs that make sure attorneys at law firms and in corporate counsel departments have the tools that they need to succeed is a goal that will, you know, help all attorneys, and it becomes much broader, I think, than diversity. It's just good practices, and we keep saying here that what we sell is our talent, and the most important thing we can do is make sure that our talent, you know, just keeps getting better and better.
Joe, can you quickly give folks the info on the MCAA website?
Minority Corporate Counsel Association is at mcca.org. com. All of the research portfolio and the information that I mentioned, all of our studies and surveys is available free of charge to members and non-members alike. So go to mcca.com and get that information.
Terrific. Well, thank you to both of you for joining us. We're going to be back in just a minute with more Capital Thinking.
We're always talking business. Talk to an expert. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back. We are joined by three of my colleagues at Patton Boggs who want to come talk a little bit about the Committee on Foreign Investments in the U.S., also known as CFIUS, one of those entities that you may not know a lot about, but which has a great deal of influence over economic activity here in the United States as we deal with folks abroad. I'm joined by Paul Bezosi, Dan Waltz, and Stephen McHale. And let me start with Dan or Stephen and ask one of you guys to explain what CFIUS is intended to do and what its mission is.
Well, as the name suggests, it's a committee that reviews foreign investment in the U.S., and it's intended and designed specifically to focus on the national security implications that may arise when a non-U.S. company acquires a U.S. company. It's chaired by the Treasury Department, but it's a very broad interagency panel that includes representatives from the Departments of Justice, Homeland Security, Commerce, Defense, State, the U.S. Trade Representative. You've got the Director of National Intelligence who provides threat analysis. So what happens is, if a foreign company is acquiring a U.S. company, and if the parties agree that there may be national security concerns raised by the acquisition, they will make a voluntary filing with this CFIUS committee and basically seek their review and approval, which the committee can grant either outright or with conditions.
Well, let me stick with you, Dan, for a minute. The last time I remember seeing CFIUS in the news was some wind farm out on the West Coast before the election day. Talk to us about the types of transactions that CFIUS is most likely to get engaged with reviewing.
Well, traditionally, you know, the focus was on foreign companies acquiring U.S. defense contractors. But what we've seen is a kind of broadening of the definition of national security so that now, in that case, for example, which is a rather extreme case, a Chinese company acquiring and building wind farms was ordered to stop and sell its U.S. holdings because those wind farms were located next to a bombing range. You're seeing a focus on what's called critical infrastructure, that was raised in part in the Dubai Ports World case several years ago, and also on U.S. energy sources. There was a report in the press today that a Chinese company planning to buy a Canadian company that has certain leases on the outer continental shelf of the U.S. is submitting a filing to CFIUS to get their review. And the concern there seems to be Chinese acquisition of U.S. oil resources.
Gotcha. Well, let me shift to Stephen and have Stephen sort of walk us through the filing and review process for one of these.
As Dan said, it usually starts with the parties to a transaction agreeing that there may be a national security issue and voluntarily submitting an application to CFIUS. There's a formal application process that the parties make a joint submission and answer about 46 questions about everything to do with their two companies, their plans for the companies, information on their ownership and directors and officers and that sort of thing. CFIUS has 30 days under the statute to review that transaction and clear it or decide that it needs to further investigate for an additional 45 days. If it goes into a further investigation, we'll be looking at all the details of the transaction and may come back to the parties and potentially negotiate some mitigation, ultimately CFIUS can just try to impose mitigation on the parties, such as perhaps spinning off the particular sensitive part of the transaction, or indeed prohibiting the transaction altogether. At the end of the process, as happened in Oregon, if CFIUS actually blocks a transaction and tells a party to divest, and the party refuses to do that, CFIUS can make a recommendation to the president, and the president, within 15 days of receiving that recommendation, will make a decision on whether to uphold CFIUS or not. That very rarely happens. In fact, I think until this Oregon transaction, it hadn't happened for 20-odd years. But when the president makes that sort of decision, it is supposed to be not reviewable in the courts. In fact, that has not stopped the Chinese wind farm concern that Dan mentioned. They're actually suing CFIUS and trying to get this decision overturned. We'll see how the courts dispose of that.
Interesting. Well, let me shift to Paul. Paul, what are the consequences if a party doesn't file with CFIUS?
Well, I think this latest case involving the wind farm is a classic example. This was a case where there was not a filing, and the transaction came to the attention of the Treasury Department through the media. And a filing was required to be made, and after the transaction had closed, you now have the CFIUS and now the president directing that the assets be the transaction be reversed or unwound. So a lot of companies, since you particularly can go in and consult informally with CFIUS as to whether or not there's a potential issue here, increasingly are exploring before moving forward with any transaction, what if any potential problems there might be, because you can be required to unwind or, as Steve was talking about, subjected to mitigating requirements imposed after the fact.
Interesting. So we've talked a lot about this wind farm case, and Stephen, I don't know if there are other examples that are relevant to talk about or that have decisions that have really made an impact on how these processes work the last few years.
Well, I think the interesting development that we've seen, as Dan suggested, is a bigger focus by CFIUS on where the business, the U.S. business, may be located. And we've had several instances in the last couple of years of CFIUS
getting involved because the facility was located near what's regarded as some sort of sensitive national security site. For example, the Chinese a Chinese company was prohibited from purchasing a gold mine because it overlooked a Nevada test range. That can be very problematic because a lot of national security sites actually aren't necessarily publicly known, and therefore the parties might actually not know when they're going into a transaction that there's a national security issue that they have to go to CFIUS about and could find out about it quite some time afterwards. I think actually that's probably the case in the Argonne transaction.
Interesting. Well, Paul, got time, I think, for one more. There's some talk about increasing CFIUS's jurisdiction. So what happens if you give more power to this entity?
Well, yes, there's been a recent House Intelligence Committee report that focused in particular on concerns regarding investment by a couple of Chinese companies in the telecom sector, which is another sensitive infrastructure area that attention has been focused on in the past. And even talking about having CFIUS be required to review purchasing agreements between potential partners. And obviously, that would greatly expand the number of transactions. I think now maybe 100 or so each year are subject to CFIUS review, expand the number of transactions that would be subjected to such such reviews, obviously delay potentially completion of those transactions, and finally just generally impose, I think, a certain degree of uncertainty in the business transaction process when you're going out and looking for deals. So it's not clear where this is headed, but those could be the consequences and more.
Interesting. Well, gentlemen, we'll have to leave it there for folks who want more information. They are free to come to the Patton Boggs website and check out Paul Bozzozzi, Dan Waltz, and Stephen McHale's bios there and contact them there. We're going to be back next week with another episode of Capital Thinking. Have a great weekend.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.